This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
You'd like to come and join us over here on the panel. I think we have two other members of the panel, I hope are here. Erin Porter, Vice President of the NUS, and also Leslie Curry, Senior Project Officer from SPAR. It's now over to you for questions, both to John Hayes and to the rest of the panel. Same format as before. If you'd like to just raise your hand, I'll try and get the microphone to you. It'd be helpful, I think, with such a large panel, if you'd like to specify who in particular you'd like to answer the question. So I have a lady here. Can I get another person ready with the microphone following that? One over the far side, yeah.
Hello, I'm Rosemary Tomkinson from the University of Manchester. Could I start with an aside? I'm really addressing this to Janice. Some concern, maybe this is slightly cynical, over the UK PLC view is this smacking of British imperialism. As Patricia said, we are all international, and I think we've got a lot to learn from students and staff from overseas ourselves. Their views, their experiences, and their cultures of learning. So I think we in the UK have got a lot to learn from those people who come to us. But I really want to talk about joined-up thinking. What you described were excellent co-curricular experiences. But I'd like to challenge a view, which I do find very often, we pussyfoot around the curriculum and the view that the curriculum itself is inviolate. If we are responsible for the development of professionals of the future who will face wicked challenges, in other words, ones which we can hardly conceive of but which are constantly changing, much beyond our own expertise, in order to cope and to actually make a difference, I think we need to find different ways also of exploring the curriculum, of being highly creative in exploring the curriculum in partnership with students to prepare them for the future. For example, what does it mean to be an engineer, not just talking about the content, not just talking about thermodynamics, but experiencing how to be creative and collaborative, side by side with and integrated with curriculum content.
Okay, thank you. I think we've got your point. Janice, do you want to begin on that? How do we focus on the curriculum to make sure that we are preparing students in the right way, not just co-curricular, but the curriculum itself?
But just to deal with your aside, I have been accused of many things over the years, but cultural imperialism is not one of them. I agree absolutely with you. I don't want to leave you with the impression that this is actually developing what we have called extracurricular or co-curricular without any recourse or involvement of our international students and indeed our international staff. And that's the whole point about it. This is a partnership across the board. So this is something I think that we will we are indeed actually taking forward. So it simply just is not an approach of home students being involved. I said that many of the things that we are doing and across our awards actually, there is a theme in which students themselves can actually make a demand, and I mean that in a positive sense, about what they want to do. So it's co-creating, in a sense, what they're doing both outside and inside the curriculum. And I also don't want to leave you with the impression that I see or that the things that we're doing across the 1994 group see as entirely separate. It has to be integrated. And in many of our approaches, so for example, if you take the Queen Mary Draper's Award, these are in a sense bringing skills which are traditionally thought of as extracurricular into the curricula. And at Exeter, we have had an independent work experience module that actually, in a sense, allows law student and law staff to think about how that applies to their curriculum. In psychology, it's different. In engineering, it's different. So I really do agree with you. But actually, I think it's easy to say and very difficult to do because a lot of our academics and course organisers and programme coordinators think about curricula in terms of a number of credits and jealously guard them for what they regard as content. So I think one of the key challenges for us is to actually think about how we do, not just think about a skill in problem solving or in critical analysis. What does that really mean for lifelong learning and in the workplace, and how do we really bring that into the curricula? So I applaud your questions. I think they're the right ones.
Thank you. John Hayes, did you want to say something about particularly relating the curriculum to what students will do afterwards? Is it always essential, or can you sometimes just do a curriculum which is for its own sake?
I studied politics at Nottingham, actually, but much of what I learned at the University of Nottingham and most of what I enjoyed happened outside of the curricula. And I do think the student experience has to be seen in that broad way. I talked a lot about part-time learning, more flexible learning, and so on. One of the great challenges if we move to that kind of approach, an approach where the rhythms and patterns of learning match the rhythms and patterns of more kinds of people's lives, one of the important challenges is ensuring that all of those things that I gained outside the curriculum are available to the people who engage in that way. And that's going to be very important, and I think it requires a lot of thought and further study, and I invite the 94 group to take their work further in that direction. Because if people are engaging in different ways, there's a risk that what they'll engage with is a much narrower experience. Getting that right is going to be tough. There is good practice abroad, but it needs to be distilled, and we need to look at ways which can be exported. As far as the curriculum itself is concerned, one of the challenges in an advanced economy is that education and skills needs become increasingly dynamic because the economy becomes more dynamic. So curricula will have to change at a greater pace. And the way in which we make them responsive, we've spoken about employer demand and learner demand should be factored into this too, again, will require new thinking. I agree that part of that will, I think, to look at more collaborative models, a different kind of paradigm for how for the relationship between the teacher and the taught. And I think we're going to go through a period of quite radical change in those terms if we're going to deal with some of the challenges that have already been mentioned since I've been here. And I've only been here for half an hour.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, further questions? See your hand right over there towards the back. If we can get the microphone there. And then we've got the one here first. So that was the one I already had lined up. We'll come to you after that. So, yeah, gentleman here, thank you.
Hello there. Kit Friend from University of the Arts London. My question is primarily to John. We've already had some speakers today talk about how good it is at prioritising STEM subjects, but that seems to directly contrast with the evidence that the creative industries are the biggest growth sector for us to look towards in the next 10 years, certainly. Our art colleges across the country have been decimated by the RAE's cuts to their research funding. And we're still not having the subsidy we need to provide a decent education experience for creative students. Okay. What can we look forward to you doing about that?
Thank you very much. I mean, the framework clearly put a great emphasis on STEM. I think you've largely supported most of the framework. But what about that point that a lot of the work is going to come from the creative industries?
Well, I told you I studied politics. I mean, I'm a social scientist, not a scientist. I mean, I believe that all of life is about pursuit of truth and beauty, and that is an aesthetic view of the world, isn't it, rather than a scientific one. I'm more interested, really, in metaphysics than personally speaking, than physics. So I do come to this with a certain prejudice, you'll understand. Nevertheless, it is important that we boost STEM, and the reason it's important is that in competitive terms, we are falling well behind. In that respect, and that's highlighted by some of the studies that I mentioned in my speech. Excuse me if my response is a bit muffled, but I'm sucking a mint at the same time as I'm speaking to you, which is slightly rude. What Leach says, for example, highlights the competitive challenges we face in respect of some of the core skills that STEM deliver. Other studies reveal that that we lack sufficient people with STEM skills. I regularly speak, for example, to the industry that I was once in, which is the information systems industry, the IT industry, and they still are having massive problems recruiting at almost every level, actually, not just at graduate and postgraduate level, but at levels below that as well. So we do have to approach those things with some seriousness, and I think that's why the framework document focuses on them. Where I think I'd find a synthesis in Hegelian terms with you, sir, is we mustn't approach those things at the same time as excluding all of those other rich and good things about education, which, as I said at the outset, are close to my own prejudices.
I think so. I think synthesis in Hegelian terms means you sort of largely agree, yes. Point over there.
Hello. Hello, my name's Dave Lewis. I work for the student unions at University of the Arts and LSE. My specific question for John is around, I was wondering if you could say a few comments around how important it is for a powerful and strong student union movement, and how important it is that you think NUS at a national level should be campaigning for the voice of students. But also, I think, for a broader question for the panel, when universities aren't delivering on the student experience or misleading students before they arrive, and when students don't feel like they've had a positive experience at the university, what role do you think student unions and NUS should have nationally in challenging those universities who fail to deliver on student expectations?
OK, I'll go to John first and I'll come to some of the others after that.
I'm an immense fan of NUS, as they know, by the way, because I've told them that. The relationship I've had with NUS since I had this job has been highly professional. I've greatly valued the advice they've offered me, the expertise which they have. I both enjoy and benefit from the dialogue I have with NUS. I think they would confirm that. I'm immensely sympathetic to the essence, the inference of your question, because I'm not only a supporter of NUS, I'm a supporter of unions generally. My father was a shop steward. My grandfather's a chairman of his union branch. I'm a trade unionist myself. So I have another prejudice as well. I'm displaying all my prejudices before this audience.
Would you have put the NUS, if you'd been in charge now and you were setting up the review of student finance, would you have put the NUS on that review body?
It's something we debated internally. I've made the case that I think the student voice is very important in that regard, and I think the student voice should be heard by that review.
Okay.
And I've made that case to my boss, David Willetts, and I think he's broadly sympathetic to that view as well, as you may have already made clear to NUS. So I think the student voice is important. On a more fundamental level, however, it is true that NUS are going to play a very important role in some of the things I argued in my speech, quantifying and measuring the quality of the student experience, understanding the changing nature of the relationship between teacher and taught, the teaching and learning point that I also made in my speech. But actually, a lot of that's got to come from within the university community too, in partnership with student representatives. So I don't see that as principally an adversarial issue. I think it's about working together to define better ways of measuring and accounting for that experience. I mean, after it was Hefke, and I met them recently to discuss this, initiated the surveying of students in respect of their experience. I know very much in concert with NUS and supported by them. But it's got to come from the community itself rather than something that's lobbied for and argued for by NUS to an unwilling or resistant university and college sector. So I look for a collaborative model rather than a confrontational model, because although I am an associate member of the Association of Teachers and Learners, I'm an immensely moderate trade unionist, as you might have guessed.
Okay, thanks very much. Aaron obviously wanted to say something on this. And
well, of course, it won't come as any surprise whatsoever for me to say the importance of NUS and students' unions. But the reason I say that, and I think it's particularly significant over the coming years, is because I think that NUS and students' unions have a role to play about promoting the sense of academic community, which has started to be eroded in quite a significant way over the last couple of decades. And I think as NUS can start to really promote that to become something of significance for students in terms of the way in which we engage with our institutions, that needs to be championed more and more over the coming years as we're starting to hear more utilitarian language, more consumer, sort of hard consumerist language. I think it's NUS's responsibility to be just as strong to be talking about an academic community. And in terms of how NUS and students' unions can respond to institutions that aren't living up to what they've either claimed to say that they were going to deliver during the application process and in what they said in their prospectuses, I think we need to be harder on this because the costs to the students are greater than ever before. I think there's a role for students' unions to continue to ensure that if academic representation is genuinely at the heart of what they do, we'll become more focused in on what institutions are saying and how we can respond to that. And that's an important tide to continue to ride on over the next few years.
I just want to bring in the other panel members first. And we may want to broaden it a little bit because we haven't talked much about admissions here in relationship to the student enhancing student experience. Indeed,
One I thought it was so interesting that the questioner talked about the information that someone gets before they come to university or to higher education. And I think that's something we believe is very important, that the applicant experience is part of the student experience. That it's a continuity, as we know that these splits are artificial, but institutions and student unions and NUS have to be very aware of this issue of the continuity from initially thinking about HE right through. And I think Aaron's point is well made, that institutions have to be careful about what they're saying, they have to think about what they're saying, and they have to put the resources into thinking about it, getting the information right. And that's a challenge. You know, there are many calls on institutions' resources, but that's part of what they have to do.
And also why we've got you here, because you're from the supporting admissions, professionals in admissions. I mean, specifically, the framework says much more information to go to applicants about what sort of mode of study, length of study, time. How much detail do you think is expected from that, should be given in that form from universities?
Yeah, I remember that comes back to information, advice and guidance too, doesn't it? Because, as we all know, just putting enormous amounts of information on the web doesn't achieve much. I think we have colleagues here from the QAA who are concerned with this issue and about bringing the information forward. I think that's something I can't easily answer because there's an enormous amount of information that could be there, but it has to be delivered in a way that is convenient and possible for people to engage with.
Okay, and Simon, you want to say?
The point I was going to make, you referenced misleading students. I think the institution that thinks it can do that in today's world of technology and the information flow that happens would be very, very foolish and naive. I think one of the things that is a huge opportunity is the power that technology gives institutions to deliver much better, more personalised information sets to students. I think the framework is interesting, and I think some of the challenges are ones we know is around some of the language of our institutions. Does a registry mean anything to a student that's coming in? How do we actually prepare students as they come in? And I'm sure that the framework and its focus on pre-arrival information will provide quite a welcome focus around how we can improve that in ways which are meaningful to students. And I'm aware there's a lot of work already taking place across the sector that is looking at this and is starting to make inroads into providing information delivered in the right time and in the right way and with the right kind of language.
Can I just sort of follow up on that? Because I mean, the theme of this morning has all been about better support for students, whether it's accommodation, financial advice, information, careers and guidance. Let me just play devil's advocate. Janice, isn't there a danger that we just mollycoddle students too much and that they don't learn to grow up and cope for themselves? I'll bring in John on this as well, but Janice first. I mean, we may be doing too much for students, mightn't we?
I can't see that happening except in the sense of, I personally believe it's very dangerous for us to move down this consumerist students as consumers approach, because there's a very important point there. They do not purchase their degrees, and they are actually working, I think, to so that in a sense we are not marking our, as academics, we're not marking our own work. They have to be stretched and challenged, and I think that's what we're setting up. And I think that's why the notion of the student experience, the notion of stretch and challenge of our students, is moving away from the notion of mollycoddling. And I think actually, in a way, it's almost disrespectful to say that students themselves have that approach, because that's not my experience. I think students expect a value from what they get out of universities. To my mind, it is broader than the curriculum. It has to do with the whole thing that they're doing in their 3-4 years or part-time, the number of years that they're with an HE institution. And that actually ultimately, I think, is to prepare them for their life, but also for the world of work within their life.
Go on.
Well, that's very interesting, because I think we're beginning to uncover here an interesting, perhaps not dilemma, but certainly a challenge, possibly a paradoxical one. I share the view about utility. I'm not very keen on utility, really. I'm not really keen on utilitarianism of any kind. I've already told you I'm an aesthete, so I hardly would be. But equally, I do buy this point about value for money, that it's perfectly reasonable to understand that the student experience should not be primarily utilitarian, while simultaneously and apparently paradoxically wanting greater measurement and indeed proof of value for money. Now, proof of value for money may not be narrowly about the curriculum. It may be about many other things that deliver a quality student experience. But nonetheless, people pay more, as we've heard. Understandably, they will see themselves in a different way. And that's the difference I tried to highlight, albeit imperfectly, between being a consumer and being more consumerist. I agree with you about not defining students as merely consumers and not defining education merely as a kind of sausage machine. I propose that all my political life. But nonetheless, I don't think we should duck the issue of measurement of value for money and the quality of experience. And that's why I'm so keen on being more rigorous, as NUS have argued on this panel, about teaching and learning and challenging that too. And the other point I wanted to say just finally was just to re-emphasise, as a former student union treasurer myself, just to re-emphasise this point, if I'm the minister, my door is always going to be open to the NUS and students.
Sure, Aaron's
noted
that.
You did very well to try and win our vote, John. But seriously, I mean, there is a difference between providing information and mollycoddling, however you say it, and there is a difference between ensuring that you support students to maximise the most of their higher education experience and mollycoddling them. And I'll also close by saying, students on arrival into higher education expect to be stretched, and therefore we need to ensure that there's as many mechanisms in place to ensure that they can be adequately stretched and have informed choices about the decisions they then choose to take.
Well, thank you very much. I fear, sadly, I'd like to keep this going. We have run over a little bit already. Apologies not for being able to bring everybody in, but I would like to thank all of our panellists, Leslie Curry, Aaron Porter, Simon Wright, Janice Kay, and John Hayes. Just to say, really, that we now move into our lunch session, and we would like to be all back in here, if you can, after lunch at 13:50, when we will have the first presentation is from Phil Willis, MP, to make sure we get some political balance today. But in the meanwhile, would you just show your appreciation to all of the speakers on our panel. Thank you very much.